Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm your host for today, David Dayan. I'm a journalist who writes for In These Times, The Intercept, New Republic, and some other publications. I'm filling in today and tomorrow for Ian Masters, who is on holiday. I'm excited about today's show. First, we're going to talk about the Democratic leadership elections in the House, which happened today, nominating Nancy Pelosi for Speaker, although the final election of that doesn't happen until January. There was also an election of Hakeem Jeffries of the Brooklyn area in a contested race against progressive icon Barbara Lee to be the caucus chair. We will talk to my Intercept colleague, Aida Chavez, who has been writing about the leadership fight. Then we'll speak with Lori Wallach of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch about what I consider the most important vote in the next Congress that isn't really getting any attention, the renegotiated NAFTA agreement. Democrats in the House now have a chance to perhaps shape that agreement or not, and we'll talk to Lori about what's at stake. Finally, we will discuss some of the most powerful financial predators in America, the private equity industry. Peter Horisky of The Washington Post has co-written an excellent long-form investigative piece on what happened when a private equity firm bought up a chain of nursing homes. It's a really powerful example of the real-world consequences of financial engineering, and we'll talk to Peter about it. Today, House Democrats held their leadership elections, and most of them were elections in name only. The ballot for Speaker read Nancy Pelosi or no, because the anti-Pelosi faction didn't actually put up an alternative. Pelosi won 203-32. We'll have a little bit more on that later. There's still a little bit of maneuvering to come on whether we'll see Nancy Pelosi as the next speaker. But there was one contested race, and the outcome tells us something about the makeup of the House Democratic Caucus and the future of progressive politics. We had Barbara Lee, the venerable anti-war progressive from Oakland, against Hakeem Jeffries, who a Brooklyn area congressman who's still in his first term, for the position of Democratic Caucus Chair. This is the number 5 position in House leadership, and it previously was held by Joe Crowley, who famously lost his seat to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Lee would have been the first black woman ever elected to a House leadership position, but she would have had to beat a fellow Congressional Black Caucus member, Hakeem Jeffries, in order to do it. So to tell us how this turned out and discuss the importance of this race, I'd like to bring in Aida Chavez. She's a journalist with The Intercept, who is one of our congressional reporters, colleague of mine. Her latest piece at The Intercept, which was written before the vote today, is Barbara Lee's race for Joe Crowley's old leadership post is a test of progressive strength in the House. Aida, thank you for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So tell us about this race. What happened?
So it was a really tight race. I believe they were just 10 votes apart. Hakeem Jeffries won over Barbara Lee. And one of the takeaways from this race, I think, is the progressive energy that was behind Barbara Lee, because it was like a grassroots movement backing her for the position, and that hasn't really happened before in that way, because normally organizations don't get involved in these internal elections.
Right. Yeah, this is something interesting. That actually was an outside campaign supporting and endorsing Barbara Lee. There was an outside website set up. This is almost unheard of. And the reason why it was sort of unheard of is that it was thought as too hard for an outside group to really affect internal caucus politics. And that seems to be how it played out.
Right. And I think it shows a lot about the energy on the Democratic side right now, specifically when it comes to progressivism. And I think there's a reason that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez initially floated Barbara Lee's name as who she would like to see as speaker. And the fact that that's the name that came up, I think that shows that progressives kind of consider her like an icon and would have really liked to see her in that position to define where the party is going in the future.
Right. And yet they come up short. So maybe we should talk about Hakeem Jeffries. So Jeffries, in addition to being a CBC member, is actually a member, I believe, of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. But he doesn't have that icon status that a Barbara Lee has. And in fact, there are some things that show him to be a little bit more moderate than Lee. Tell us about Hakeem Jeffries a little bit.
Yeah, so he's actually pro-charter schools. He's a big money Democrat. He doesn't have the progressive stance on Israel, and he's in good standing with Andrew Cuomo and the New York political machine. And so some people might argue that he is still progressive in relative to other members of the House, but compared to Barbara Lee, he really is more toward the middle and more of what would have been considered progressive maybe 5 years ago.
Right, right. Yeah, I pulled a couple numbers. Jeffries is someone who in his 2018 election only raised 1.3% of his campaign funds from people who made contributions under $200. So this is really big money. And nearly half of his money came from corporate PACs at a time when dozens of candidates running in the midterms rejected corporate PAC money entirely. So it does seem like Joe Crowley, who was sort of an avatar of big money machine New York politics, has been replaced by someone who is following a position of big money machine New York politics.
Right. And I think a lot of people are reducing this leadership election as a matter of generational change because of his age.
Right.
But really, he's closer to Crowley's age, and he has similar politics. And so the generational change also has to be backed by someone who is on the economic left as well and anti-war and all that.
Right, sure. So I think the reason that this generational argument was sort of made is that, you know, Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, Jim Clyburn, who have all dominated the Democratic leadership for so long, they're all in their late 70s. Barbara Lee is in her early 70s, and Hakeem Jeffries is 48. So there was a generational situation, regardless of the ideology at play, that was present in this race. And maybe it does show that, you know, the Democratic caucus is desiring to vote for younger leadership. Of course, that played sort of against the type, since the younger leadership that's coming in, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ayanna Pressley and Ilhan Omar, are people who are very strongly progressive and were on the side of Barbara Lee. So it was a little bit mixed up.
Right. I also found it interesting that I do think the big generational gap is a problem. And I think it's a problem that, like, the same handful of people have been up atop for so long. But I think it's interesting that people made the generational argument when talking about Barbara Lee, but not when talking about Steny Hoyer.
Right, who's faced no opposition whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, how these leadership races usually play out is the member of the leadership is usually someone that raised a lot of money and gave it to candidates who were coming in who needed the support. And this is a way to sort of call back that favor. I mean, that's certainly how it's worked for a number of years, and certainly with Hoyer, and Pelosi is a big fundraiser. And, you know, I mean, I think that's the fear, right? That Jeffries is someone who has this outreach to, you know, whether it's the community in New York or corporate PACs, has the ability to play this same game that has been played for so long within the Democratic leadership. You were on the Hill today. You were looking into all this. What was the reaction to this close loss for Barbara Lee, who does have a great deal of respect, I feel, and came very close to winning this? You know, great deal of respect within the Democratic caucus. What was the reaction from members, if you talked to anyone?
There was some disappointment among Barbara Lee supporters, actually. One of the more, like, vocally disappointed members was Ro Khanna. He's a big supporter of Lee. But I do think the Democrats are, you know, going to rally around Jeffries anyways. There is still going to be unity at the end of the day.
We actually have Representative Khanna on the show tomorrow, so we'll have to ask him about that. I'm speaking with Aida Chavez. She's a journalist, congressional reporter with The Intercept. We're talking about the House leadership elections and the reaction to them. I did see that Joe Crowley pronounced himself incredibly proud to have Hakeem Jeffries succeed him. So we'll just put that aside. So you wrote that this race would be a test of the strength of House progressives. What do you feel that this outcome really shows about where the progressives, whether in the Progressive Caucus or within the caucus more generally, what it shows about them and where they're at?
I think it shows that regardless of what the Democratic Party is saying right now about thinking about the future of the party, where it's going, these fringe ideas that are now mainstream, the fact that they elected another big money Democrat instead of Barbara Lee, it shows that they're not actually ready to take that wing of the party seriously yet.
Yeah. It's sort of that next step. And especially the fact that Jeffries is so inundated with corporate PAC donations. And this, you know, I mean, I think you wrote about this, the fact that, I mean, dozens, if not hundreds, of congressional candidates this cycle rejected corporate PAC money. That seems like something that is pretty starkly at odds with the way that the caucus is going. And I wonder if some pressure will be brought to bear on Jeffries on that particular issue.
It might, because I think small dollar donations are the new normal now. I think now that people see that you can win like that you can govern like that, it's just going to be expected. We're going to start expecting more of our lawmakers.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to briefly touch on the speaker race. Pelosi got 203 votes from Democrats today. She actually needs 218 votes on the floor of the House on January 3rd. So there seems to be a little work left to go for her to lock up the speaker position. Is the feeling on the Hill that she's still, you know, is in a little bit of peril here?
Not really. I feel like Nancy Pelosi has kind of proved that she can get votes on anything no matter what. And so, of course, there is still a chance for like a last minute challenger. But for now, no one really seems to be particularly worried about that.
Right. I do see that Pelosi made a major concession today to the so-called Problem Solvers Caucus, this bipartisan group of Republicans and Democrats who are moderates. She needed to pick up 8 votes from the Democrats in the Problem Solvers Caucus. And she did some concessions around amendments and getting certain bills to the floor if they have bipartisan support. You know, one other thing I wanted to touch on, because I know you have been reporting on this. Today in the U.S. Senate, there was a 63-37 vote to advance a resolution seeking to end U.S. support for the conflict in Yemen. And I know this is something that was voted on. It was Ro Khanna's, actually, legislation in the House that the House leadership, the Republican leadership, didn't allow to get to a vote. But it was allowed today. And on a bipartisan basis, Democrats and Republicans voted in pretty wide numbers to end this participation. What does this say about the changing sort of politics in Congress around matters of war?
I actually thought it was pretty remarkable that we even got to this point. I really wasn't expecting so many Republicans and even Democrats who were holding out last time to change their minds. And I think it's largely because of recent events and things that have been worsening the crisis there. And I actually think this is one of the biggest pro-human rights foreign policy moves I can think of in decades.
Yeah, I can't think of a bigger exercise of the War Powers Act since Vietnam. I mean, this is really historic almost in a way. And obviously, I think it was a reaction also to the killing of Jamal Khashoggi and obviously Saudi Arabia's participation in the war and the U.S. sort of backing the Saudis. And this comes on the heels of President Trump defiantly saying that he will back Saudi Arabia no matter what, because we need them to keep spilling oil out and buying our weapons. In terms of that, do you think at this point, with that broad bipartisan vote in the Senate, that the House might take this up this year, or would it have to move into when the Democrats take over?
I think it's much more likely in the new Congress.
Yeah, because obviously already they have voted it down. Paul Ryan essentially rejected the attempt to bring that to the floor. So, yeah, but it is pretty amazing. And also, you know, on this day when Barbara Lee loses narrowly this race for House leadership, you had a resolution largely put forward by Bernie Sanders, along with some other members. But Bernie really sort of put his reputation on the line and his political capital on the line for this vote and was able to get it done. So it's sort of a mixed bag in terms of what the progressives were able to do today.
Definitely.
All right. Well, Aida, thank you very much for coming on the show. Aida Chavez is a journalist with The Intercept covering Congress. And her latest piece was Barbara Lee's race for Joe Crowley's old leadership post is a test of progressive strength in the House. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
All right, we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back with Lori Wallach of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch to talk about the renegotiation of NAFTA.
Right up, following the leader. Follow the leader, I can't mistake. Follow the leader, I can't mistake. A verified freestyle, lyrics of fury. My third eye make me shine like jury. You're just a renter rapping, your rhymes are minute made. I'll be here when it fade, I watch it flip like a renegade. I can't wait to break and eliminate on every trade of a snake, so stay awake and follow and follow, because the tempo's a trail, the stage is a cage, the mic is a third rail. I'm Rakim.
Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm David Dayan, filling in for Ian Masters today. We're now going to talk about what I think is the most critical vote in the new Congress that you might not have heard about. And I'm talking about the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement. This is the renegotiation of NAFTA. It's called the USMCA. And in a divided Congress, it could be the one area, really, where something might actually move forward and Democrats have the ability to dictate terms that will impact trade policy, which covers so much of our daily life, from healthcare to environment to worker rights to food safety, for decades to come. So what will the Democrats do? Well, joining us to help answer that question is Lori Wallach, the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. She's a recognized progressive leader on trade policy. Whenever I have a question about trade, she's my go-to source. And she's here to walk us through the USMCA and the stakes in the next Congress. Lori, welcome to Background Briefing.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. So bring us up to speed. So back in October, the U.S., Mexico, and Canada reached agreement on this deal. I guess Mexico just gave Jared Kushner an award for negotiating this. What are the essential elements of this that make it different from NAFTA?
Well, just to start with, the text isn't the transformational replacement of the corporate rigged trade agreement model that NAFTA hatched in the 1990s. And that's true on the merits of what's in the agreement, regardless of Donald Trump's efforts to rebrand it with a new name. So we're not going with the rebrand. We call it NAFTA 2.0. Now, there are some important things in the agreement that are improved relative to NAFTA. There are some things that are new bad things that were added, and there's a lot of unfinished business. So the biggest thing that's better is the agreement largely eliminates the outrageous investor-state dispute settlement system. Those are those tribunals where multinational corporations are empowered under NAFTA to attack U.S., Mexican, and Canadian domestic laws in front of tribunals of three corporate lawyers. And the lawyers get to order the corporations be paid unlimited sums by taxpayers for any claimed violation of their new special NAFTA rights. And they can even demand compensation for future expected profits, but for the environmental or health law they say violates NAFTA. Almost $400 million has been paid out so far in 25 years of NAFTA on investor state attacks against water policy, toxics bans, zoning rules, energy policies. And the getting rid of that is a very big deal also with respect to the rest of the world where countries want to get out of this system because it's another agreement. Another big improvement is the provisions in NAFTA that used to force the export of natural resources, oil, gas, water, timber, ores, have been removed. So if a country wants to conserve their resources, those mandatory export rules are out. Mm-hmm. There are improvements in labor standards. There are labor standards that, for once, would actually require Mexico to guarantee real secret ballot elections on union contracts. And Mexico is required to get rid of all the fake so-called protection racket unions in 4 years. Now, that first set of fixes I mentioned, that's done and it's there. The union stuff, as well as the environment chapter in NAFTA, which instead of being in a side agreement, is in the core text. The rules need some beefing up, but both the labor and environmental chapters, and the labor chapter has some improvements, are not yet subject to real enforcement. That's the biggest undone business. Right. Without real, swift, and certain enforcement, you don't have anything but words on paper. And then there's one big thing that's a lot worse. And that is the agreement has added to it some big giveaways for big pharma. So if that stuff doesn't get taken out, the NAFTA 2.0 could lock in the policies that make U.S. medicine prices outrageously high and export that bad system.
Right. And let's just
Mexico
go into
Canada.
Let's just go into a little bit of detail about this. This is about patent protections, right, for the pharmaceutical medications. It would be a longer amount of patent protection?
That's right. I mean, most people think trade agreements are about cutting border taxes called tariffs or opening up quotas. But the dirty little secret about NAFTA and the stuff we have to be worried about in NAFTA 2.0 is all the non-trade stuff. And so here we have a so-called free trade agreement that has new protectionist monopolies for special interests, pharmaceutical companies, in the form of a guaranteed additional period of monopoly, of exclusivity, and this pertains to a class of drugs called biologic medicines.
Right.
So these are the cutting-edge cancer drugs, but also these are a lot of the drugs that are, for instance, the injectables like Humira. These are the what they call large molecule drugs, cutting-edge medicines that, you know, sometimes cost $100,000 per person a year. And part of the reason they're so crazy expensive here but not in other countries is because we have this extra period of monopoly for the holder of the patent in addition to the years of patent monopoly that already the medicine gets.
Right.
And this would lock that in, which is a very bad thing.
Yeah.
People all across the country rose up during this election and said, we've had it with the ridiculous medicine prices. That's got to change. This would basically super glue the bad policies in place. Now, both the stuff that's missing, the enforcement of the labor and environmental standards, there's some other changes that need to happen in the agreement, in addition to getting rid of this outrageous medicine stuff, that can all still happen. And that's one of the things a lot of people could get confused about, because this Friday, there's going to be big news. They're signing the damn text. But that's not the end of the story.
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about. So I guess there's a sort of nascent effort from Senate Republicans to say, hey, approve this agreement real quick while we still have power in the House. But that seems very unlikely to happen. What's more likely is that Democrats come in next year and it's up to the House leadership of the Democrats to decide whether to go ahead with this agreement and put a vote on it, or to demand changes to it, right? I mean, take me through that process.
Well, that would be very logical and normal, except U.S. trade agreement policy is so anti-democratic that this agreement's going to be running under what's called the fast-track procedure.
Right.
And that is like a legislative luge run for trade agreements. So under fast-track, unlike normal legislation, the next Democratic Speaker of the House will not have control over the timing. The way fast-track works is the executive branch submits what's called implementing legislation. That's the way a trade agreement gets voted on. And that legislation must be voted on in the House and in the Senate within 90 days mm-hmm. of when it's submitted with no amendments allowed. It's a yes or no vote with limited debate. So filibuster, all that stuff doesn't apply. It's a simple majority vote in both chambers.
Right.
Now, that's a legal answer. As a political and practical matter, no president sends up a trade agreement under fast track that they know is going to go over the cliff and not get passed. That's why we knew we had beaten the Trans-Pacific Partnership when they never sent it on the fast track, because they could count the votes that we were counting, and they didn't have the votes to pass it.
Right.
So what really will happen is between now and whenever that agreement gets submitted for the fast track vote, there's going to have to be a discussion with congressional Democrats about what it would take to have them support it. Because the agreement as is, even with its important improvements, and there are other ones, they closed a big loophole that let products from China sneak in through NAFTA. They fixed a rule that used to not allow us to be able to stop trucks that didn't meet U.S. environmental or labor standards or health safety standards. And drivers that weren't meeting the hours of service rules, we couldn't stop trucks like that coming in from Mexico and Canada. Now we can. They added a very interesting wage standard. It's unclear how it will work, but the concept sets a really important precedent that a certain portion, 40% of the value of vehicles coming in with NAFTA treatment have to be made by workers making $16 an hour or more. Yeah. So there's some good stuff in there, but without the swift and certain enforcement of the labor standards and without getting that outrageous medicine stuff out, the agreement is not going to be good for workers or consumers. So some big changes are still going to have to be made. It's a work in progress. It's, you know, if it had to give it a grade, I'd call it an incomplete. More work needed.
Okay. I'm speaking with Lori Wallach, the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of Public Citizen. So let's start talking about what Democrats have an option of doing. They obviously want to make these changes. Some Democrats have already talked about making changes to the enforceability of the labor standards, the farmer stuff. Mexico and Canada have been a little bit reluctant to say that we're going to renegotiate this agreement. So I'm wondering, in the previous NAFTA, we saw certain guarantees go into, or not really guarantees, go into a side agreement. Would these changes that you're talking about, would they have to go into a side agreement, or would Democrats say, look, you got to open this up and it's all or nothing?
So one of the things that a lot of people aren't aware of is that repeatedly so-called signed, finished trade agreements under the fast track rules have been reopened and had changes made to them after they were signed. And it's a fairly endemic problem, mm-hmm. because if you can't pass your agreement, you're going to have to change your agreement. So just for instance, in the last time this kind of a scenario happened was when George Bush was president and he signed four trade agreements with Panama, Colombia, Peru, and Korea. It was in 2006. He signed them. In the fall of 2006, the Democrats won the House back. And in 2007, Bush had to renegotiate all four of those agreements. He had to take our outrageous pharma goodies, patents, etc. He had to improve labor and environmental standards. And then that still was not sufficient to fix two of those agreements. And then Obama in 2009 had to do it again.
Right.
And the Korea agreement actually got renegotiated three times before a majority could be built. And the way you do it practically, David, just depends. I mean, you can change the text of an agreement without, you know, literally reprinting the text of the agreement. You basically agree to and sign an addendum that says, you know, chapter blah, blah, article blah, blah is replaced with the following.
Right.
These amendments are part of the core agreement, subject to dispute settlement, and equally enforceable to any other part. So, but some of the things, like the pharmaceutical stuff, is going to need changes in the text.
So the wild card here seems to be this incoming freshman Democratic class. And many of them are from suburban districts. They might not have a super distinct relationship to trade. I just wrote a story at the New Republic about this. I've been looking at the websites, campaign websites of all these incoming Democrats. And of the 48 that I looked at, only two mentioned trade as an issue on their issues page. It just really wasn't discussed in the campaign, and yet it has this monumental importance, especially because it's probably one of the only things that can actually be passed, because it's something that Trump already negotiated and Senate Republicans seem to want. This wild card, are you confident that the incoming members have a point of view on trade that might align with the kinds of things that you were saying about labor standards, about environment, about pharmaceuticals? And will they align with the Democrats who are seeking better protections?
So, yeah, what's a very interesting thing is, I think, by the way, your story is terrific, and I recommend everyone to read it. What I think is...
I wasn't fishing for a compliment there.
No, but it is. It's one of the rare stories that puts in perspective how a vote like NAFTA will affect every element of our everyday lives and set a model that will impact, even though it's called a trade agreement, as you point out, it's going to affect a much broader set of issues relating to food safety and internet freedom and whether or not we can have affordable medicines, things you think of as domestic policy, but no, being written in trade agreements. So the incoming freshmen, about half of them, although it wasn't on their websites necessarily, in one way or another, in speeches, in letters, in questionnaires they filled out for different organizations, have made clear that they support the progressive trade reform agenda actively and as a priority. Some of the others, I would say, are less informed but have generally been, without a lot of detail, eager to get NAFTA, quote-unquote, fixed. And I would say there are three or four of the incoming freshman Democrats who probably, unfortunately, would have been happy to not see NAFTA changed and probably would have supported the TPP, and right. Which is to say the overwhelming majority of the Democrats coming in, the new members, will have an eye to trying to change NAFTA in the way that the progressives in Congress who've been leading the fight for trade reform have largely set up the demands. Because really, you know, the only thing I would say that's slightly different from how you characterize the situation is the reason this is going to get done isn't just because Trump's already negotiated it and the Republicans are for it. It's because, perversely, Trump effectively hijacked the trade reform agenda and mantle from progressive Democrats.
Right.
And from Democrats. And so, to some degree, he is implementing pieces of the things they've always demanded, because he has a political goal of stopping outsourcing, raising wages, not having the race to the bottom.
Right.
I'm not saying way he's negotiated the agreement right now ain't going to cut that.
Right. I mean, I would say it's sort of
some of the things he did are the right things, even despite himself.
It's like a funhouse mirror version of a progressive trade agenda, I think. It's you know, it's thinking about these things in terms of bolstering manufacturing and increasing wages, but it's doing it in such a way that still gives a whole lot to corporate interests. And actually, I want to talk about something just sort of in line with that. As you know, General Motors just announced these layoffs in plants in Canada and the U.S., 14,700 jobs. And they said there are going to be other, you know, restructuring that goes on in plants in foreign countries, but they haven't labeled what they are yet. And they say this is all just sort of a retooling. You talked earlier about this minimum wage standard, which would be this interesting model, saying that every country party to this agreement would have to pay for auto production a minimum of $16 an hour for most jobs, not every single one, but it's more of an average. Do you think that these layoffs in Canada and the U.S., the fact of where they were, the fact that they were named without the foreign plants that GM uses being named, Is this some sort of shot across the bow from the auto industry that the wage standards in this NAFTA 2.0 need to change, or cars in, made in North America might not be a going concern?
You know, I'm not sure if it's that. What I do think it reflects, though, is the totally bass-ackwards way that Donald Trump thinks about these issues. So he doesn't get that this is what the car companies do, which is to say, he can't just say, like he said in the campaign trail, I'm not going to let them outsource.
Right.
It has to do with the rules. And right now, the rules in his NAFTA replacement are not sufficient to guarantee that there won't be more outsourcing, that the wages won't continue to be pushed down. That's part of why the improvements are necessary before it's an agreement that would actually work for working people. In the same way he looks at NAFTA, he doesn't have a corporate power analysis at all, perhaps because he is himself a walking, tweeting multinational corporation. It could be a mirror problem. But the when he looks at NAFTA, the reason I said he gets some of it right almost by accident is he looks at NAFTA and he says, oh, it's this bad thing that Mexico did to the U.S. Mexican workers are stealing our jobs,
right,
which is the most stupid, uninformed, incorrect perspective given NAFTA is pretty much a made-in-America product. It was Ronald Reagan's brainchild. Bush the first negotiated it. Clinton passed it. Mexico didn't ask for half of the crazy corporate protections that were put in there. That was a U.S. agenda. We have 500 corporate advisors. And so the notion that you can fix NAFTA by adding, for instance, new rights for big pharmaceutical companies,
right,
as compared to looking at the agreement for what it was and why, therefore, what needs to be fixed. NAFTA 1.0 was a project of big multinational companies,
right,
to maximize their profits at the expense of workers in all three countries. This is not an us against them, worker from one country against worker from another country.
Right.
And so does the same kind of bizarre, it's hard to know if it's naivete or megalomania, that would have Trump say, I don't believe GM would do this to me. This is what they do.
Right.
This is what multinational companies do. They race to the bottom in wages and standards unless there are policies put in place that stop them. And in the case of Trump, he put in place policies that made it more lucrative. His tax scam, the tax bill that they passed last year, has at its heart some major tax cuts for companies that outsource.
Right.
So it may be that when GM says, well, when I look at the goodies I get if I outsource in the tax bill, and I may have to pay some higher tariffs because I won't meet the NAFTA rules, they may still come ahead thanks to Trump's tax cuts.
Well, that's absolutely so. We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank Lori Wallach. This will be fascinating to see where this goes in the next Congress, and I'm sure you'll be right on top of it. So thank you for being on.
Thank you, and the signing is this Friday. A battle royale will start in January. If folks are interested, get involved.
I was speaking with Lori Wallach, the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of Public Citizen. Okay, we'll be right back, and we're going to talk with Peter Hrysky of The Washington Post about the private equity takeover of a chain of nursing homes. Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm David Dayan, filling in for Ian Masters. And joining us now is Peter Hrysky. He's a D.C.-based investigative reporter for The Washington Post who focuses on economic and financial issues. His reporting has won a George Polk Award in 2013. And his latest investigation at the Washington Post is overdoses, bed sores, broken bones. What happened when a private equity firm sought to care for society's most vulnerable? Peter, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So maybe you should give us some background on the private equity industry. These are investment firms. I'm just wondering what their model is, their business model. And you write also that they've been branching out in recent years to businesses that serve more vulnerable segments of society. So maybe explain that too.
Right. So private equity firms, what they generally do, there's sort of variations on this model, but basically what they do is they get a group of investors together, 100 or 200 or 300 usually, which are, those investors are big entities like pension funds or insurance companies, wealthy people. They get a whole bunch of money, and then they buy companies, and then they sell the companies, and they try to turn a profit doing that. It's been amazingly successful for some people. And in more recent years, like starting around the time of the recession, you started to see them get into businesses that serve poor and otherwise vulnerable people. So, for example, private equity firms own a prison phone service. They own a lending company that, or several lending companies that are either payday lenders or short-term installment loan lenders. They moved into nursing homes. And they've moved also into buying up houses that were foreclosed upon during the crisis, and they now rent them out to some of the former residents that were in there.
Yeah, the single-family rental market. But let's talk about then this nursing home facility, Manor Care, this chain. The transaction happened with a private equity firm called the Carlyle Group, and typical for these transactions, it was not purchased with money that the private equity firm had in its investment portfolio, but through debt. Maybe talk about what the terms of this transaction were for Manor Care.
So absolutely right. That's what their model, aside, in addition to buying and selling companies, they buy the companies using a lot of debt. So in this case, they bought Manor Care for $6.1 billion, but only $1.3 billion of it came from Carlyle and its investors. So the rest was borrowed. And what happens is that debt then goes on to the company that they've purchased, which makes their financial success quite a bit shakier. Yeah. And in this case, it eventually doomed the company.
Yeah. And in this case, things seemed to fall apart when Manor Care had an additional financial burden. And that was through this tactic known as a sale leaseback. Could you describe what the Carlyle Group did?
Yeah. So this is a very common move in private equity. You see it in a lot of the retail bankruptcies that people have been writing about. What they do is they buy the company. It might be a bunch of stores. It might be a bunch of nursing homes. And they are going to make money not necessarily by improving service at those companies, but by selling the real estate. And it's called a sale leaseback because what they do is, in this case and in others, they sold all of the real estate at the company, or almost all of it, and then they agreed to lease it back. Right. Now, you wouldn't necessarily do that with your own house, but it works for them because this gave them a big pulse of money. In fact, they got back $6.1 billion, which is what they had paid for the company in the first place. Huh. And then some of that was distributed to the investors.
Yeah, it's kind of, to relate it to a house, it's almost like a home equity loan. Only the people who are living in the house don't get the money. The financial managers are
exactly
the ones who get
right.
the money.
Exactly.
So at this point, Manor Care, they were a company that was moving along. Now they have to pay interest on the debt that was loaded onto them. They have to pay rental payments for the facilities. And how do they manage this financial burden? And what was the impact of that on the operations themselves?
The amount of debt was actually the rise in the amount of long-term financial obligations at the company. It was staggering. When Carlyle bought the property or bought the company, they had less than $1 billion of debt. Mm-hmm. After they bought the company using a lot of debt, they then had $5 billion. After the real estate sale, they had $6 billion in debt. And that turned out to be the, I mean, in retrospect, looks like the straw that broke the camel's back, because as soon as that happened, they never again turned a profit or never again reported a profit in their financial statements. They started doing cost cutting. The inflation-adjusted amount they started spending on operations started to shrink. And what we saw was some patient care also suffered.
Yeah. Let's talk a little more about that, because you did some analysis both of the code violations in the company at the time that they started to cut costs. And you also, you know, had personal stories, talked to people who had loved ones at these facilities, also former workers. So what did you find about the impact of this cost cutting on the quality of care?
Well, what we saw statistically was that in the years after the sale-leaseback, which is when the debt really got overbearing, and the time they filed for bankruptcy, the number of health code violations rose 25% across the company. And this is for all kinds of things from, you know, too much medication, too little medication, not properly handling people when you're moving them so they might fall and break bones, not properly preventing or treating bed sores. There was kind of a mishmash of horrible incidents that we could see in the incident reports from the companies.
And as you noted, the violations that kept cropping up sort of all pointed back to understaffing, even though ManorCare and Carlisle said that, no, they had the same amount of staff and the same amount of nurses per facility. The kinds of things that were going wrong were things that only would happen if you didn't have enough staff.
Yeah, experts point, you know, the experts that we talked to, you know, when I would say, look, all these things were going wrong, they said that's almost always the result of staffing. And, you know, if you don't have enough people, you don't move people so that they don't get bed sores. If you don't have enough people, you don't have an extra person around to prevent a fall. And that's what we saw quite clearly in the health code violations. But we also heard it over and over from patients and also from nurses who would tell us, yeah, there just wasn't enough help, that we couldn't get to everybody as quickly as we needed to.
Yeah. Just a reminder, we're speaking with Peter Horisky. He's an investigative reporter for The Washington Post, focuses on economic and financial issues. His article that we're talking about is Overdoses, Bed Sores, Broken Bones, What Happened When a Private Equity Firm Sought to Care for Society's Most Vulnerable. The private equity firm is the Carlyle Group, and the caring for society's most vulnerable is their purchase of a company called ManorCare. I found it interesting that ManorCare, they referred you to a consultant, said that your figures weren't the figures, that you should talk to this consultant that works with us on the violations. And he kind of found the same results that you guys did.
Right. He did. It was very strange because they said, no, you're wrong. And so we found that there was a 26% rise in health code violations at the company over those 5 years. And sure enough, he found 26% of health code violations, a rise in health code violations. You know, our numbers varied in small ways, but the headline from both of our sets of figures was things weren't going well there.
The headline could have been ManorCare consultant finds this out. Anyway, so Carlisle kind of cited Medicare reimbursement reductions as the real sort of triggering event that caused financial problems at the company. But it seems to me that that's the whole point, that a company not weighted down by debt would have room to adapt to whatever changing circumstances in the marketplace or in the business took place. But ManorCare could not. And that's kind of the whole issue with private equity, isn't it?
Yeah, it makes companies risk much higher. And so if there's a little bit of a wave of bad news, you're less likely to be able to sail on. The other thing about the about Carlisle's take on what happened, you know, they're saying, look, Medicare cut our rates. We couldn't make it financially based on these new rates. But what had happened was when they did indeed cut the rates, but the reason they cut the rates is that they had raised them up way too high a year before. Mm-hmm. So in 2010, Medicare rates rose 16%. Medicare thought that was a mistake. So in 2011, they cut them by 11%. So they actually didn't suffer in a long-term way.
They kind of reverted. They reverted to the mean almost.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So what eventually happens to ManorCare?
They filed for bankruptcy earlier this year. They're now under new ownership, a nonprofit called ProMedica Health.
Got it. And what lessons do you think can be drawn from using this model, especially with a business people depend on for care for their loved ones? We've seen certainly other private equity bankruptcies, most famously at Toys R Us. We're seeing a private equity type model at Sears go into a bankruptcy process. But is there something different about using this sort of hyper-capitalism model at a nursing home that is more risky in some sense to society?
It is. I mean, it's more risky to everyone involved, because adding that much debt makes it, you know, a financial enterprise that much more difficult to manage and run.
I mean, it's one thing.
And the other thing is that with private equity is that they're, I mean, these are guys who are not saying, you know, we want to run the best nursing home in the country necessarily. They're saying, we want to run this nursing home for 3 to 5 years and make a profit on it, which is a different question.
Right, right. It just seems very interesting that it's one thing when the size of your toy is a little bit smaller because you're trying to save money. It's another thing when you're not staffing a nursing home and people are laying, screaming, looking for help and can't get it. I mean, it seems...
Well, and then the other sort of, I think some people would say, grotesque part of this is that you have some of the richest people in the world who are investing and making money off of some of the most desperate.
And some of the people who make out the most in that transaction are, of course, the private equity managers themselves who extract revenues from the company. I believe you tallied something on the order of $80 million or more in transaction fees and in annual management fees that they take because of their superior management acumen to taking from the company. That's sort of the third hand that's in the pocket is these fees and dividends that the private equity firm takes out of the company they purchase.
Right. And, you know, they took money out through the real estate sale. They took money out through these fees. And at the end of the day, taking that money out, I think some would argue within the company, took money away from proper patient care. I mean, some of the executives that we talked to on background said that, you know, in fact, their budgets, especially for upkeep and maintenance at the nursing homes, was constrained because of the debt load.
Interesting. So we're going to link to this story at backgroundbriefing.org. Before I let you go, you have also reported on something that might be interesting to our California listeners, that the initiative that is being put forward to repeal legislation that was passed here this year to end the cash bail system. That initiative effort has just submitted its signatures for the 2020 ballot. And I understand, according to your reporting, that there's a private equity tie-in there as well.
Right. So that's just one more sort of field that private equity has moved into, in which they're serving underprivileged or otherwise vulnerable people, which they own the largest bail bonds company in the country, and most of their stores are in California. So when California said, you know, we think this is a bad idea for a variety of reasons, they paid for a signature campaign, most of the largest share of the campaign to repeal, which is, as you pointed out, the effort to get it on the ballot has been successful, was footed by a private equity firm in Seattle?
Is it Seattle?
I can't remember. It's somewhere up there. Sorry.
You're doing a lot of stuff. It's no problem. Well, Peter Horisky, thank you very much for this article and your continued reporting on the private equity industry. And as I said, we will link to your story at Background Briefing. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
We were speaking with Peter Horisky, a investigative reporter for The Washington Post. His story is Overdoses, Bed Sores, Broken Bones, What Happened When a Private Equity Firm Sought to Care for Society's Most Vulnerable. This has been Background Briefing. I'm David Dayan, sitting in for Ian Masters. Thanks, as always, to producer Graham Fitzgibbon. You can find this program at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, or SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, coworkers, whoever, on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow me on Twitter at ddayen, D-D-A-Y-E-N. And I also put out a newsletter with links to all of the stories that I write at various outlets. That newsletter is at tinyletter.com/DavidDayen. I'll be back again tomorrow, sitting in for Ian. We have some excellent guests, including Congressman Ro Khanna, environmental journalist Kate Aronoff, and author of The Curse of Bigness, Tim Wu. Until then, we'll see you.